ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My intention, unless you prefer otherwise, is to briefly discuss the statute of limitations issue in the Brewer case and then turn to the—
I am interested in that issue.
Then turn to the genuine issues of material fact. Wallace v. Cato, the Court held that the proper analysis for determining the accrual of a claim is by—a 1983 claim is by determining the closest common law analogy. In this case, the closest common law analogy is malicious prosecution, in which an element of the claim is the favorable termination of the underlying proceeding. In this case, there was not a favorable termination until the charges were finally dismissed and Mr. Brewer was exonerated in 2000.
I have a problem with that characterization because there's no evidence of other elements of malicious prosecution here. In other words, the prosecutors may have acted on improper or incorrect evidence, but they didn't operate with malice. They didn't operate with lack of probable cause.
Well, the prosecutors— I'm not talking about the prosecutors. I'm talking about Dr. Hain and Dr. West. And we do say they acted with malice and that they basically, that they deliberately lied to the prosecutors when they stated that these were bite marks.
But even without the bite marks, there's probable cause. You've got some very, very suspicious circumstances in both of these cases.
Well, that's true. And maybe that's an issue for our state law malicious prosecution claim. But this is a 1983 claim based on deliberate falsification of evidence. The closest analog—
I think the point is whether that is the closest analog here.
You look at Heck versus Humphrey, which was a case about Brady and a case where the plaintiff claimed that there was a misleading voice identification procedure used at trial. And the court there said the closest analog is malicious prosecution. You look at the Owens case out of the Fourth Circuit, which was a Brady case. Closest analog, malicious prosecution. You look at the Bradford case out of the Ninth Circuit. All these we cite in our brief.
Is this three-year statute the statute for malicious prosecution?
It is the general residual.
It seems kind of inconsistent to use the general negligence statute of limitations, but then use the malicious prosecution accrual.
We actually filed our case within 1 year of the dismissal of the charges and exoneration. So, yes, even if you use the malicious prosecution statute of limitations, okay, we would satisfy.
Under your theory.
Okay. Right, right. And so I think, I think under Heck, I think these other courts of appeals, all the authority shows this is malicious prosecution. I don't see what other analog there would be. It's not a false arrest analog. That's clear from looking at Wallace versus Cato. So I think it's pretty clear that malicious prosecution is the proper analog here, and that we have met.
So even if you can't meet its requirements, it's the closest thing we have to analogize.
Precisely.
That's your argument.
Precisely. Okay. Yes. And I think every court of appeals to look at the issue so far has—
well, they've done it under different fact.
Not really. I mean, the Ninth Circuit case, Bradford, was a fabrication case, just like this one. The Fourth Circuit case was a Brady case, failure to disclose exculpatory evidence, and I think that's no closer to, or let me put it another way, the fabrication claim is no more distant from malicious prosecution analog than is a failure to disclose exculpatory evidence. So for that reason, those reasons, we do believe we've satisfied the statute of limitations here. With respect to the evidence of—
can you square for me the notion that you can hold these defendants liable under 1983 as state actors, but they can't assert qualified immunity as state actors? Can you square that for me? Because it seems to have sort of an inherent unfairness to it.
Well, it does seem inconsistent, but I mean, the Supreme Court has held as much in Richardson versus McKnight, where it said that the private prison guards there were state actors, but under the circumstances, they could not claim qualified immunity. Sixth Circuit said the same thing in the Teep case that we have cited in our brief. But I do, so, so I don't, I understand the point, but that's the law. I think, and I don't think it really matters here.
All right. So if we find they are entitled to assert qualified immunity, then my question is, what evidence? I understand you're arguing recklessness as well, and we'll get to that, or someone will get to that. But what evidence do you have that they intentionally set these two gentlemen up? That they intentionally, knowing these weren't bite marks, knowing that these guys were not actually the right criminal and so on, knowing that, nonetheless lied, fabricated evidence. What evidence do you have of intent?
Well, there's no, I mean, and they never stated intent, so it has to be circumstantial evidence, right? And the circumstantial evidence is that, I mean, we spelled it out in a particular section of our brief, but it includes the fact that these claims are so outrageous and that they have no scientific basis, and that, and in particular...
Well, you... Go ahead.
In particular, the fact that their claims were based on, in both cases, that these alleged bite marks match the upper teeth only of Mr. Brewer and Mr. Brooks. And in fact, Mr. Brooks was only the upper two teeth. And we have a declaration from some experts in this area who say it is very rare to say that only one for only one arch to make a bite mark, but is unusual and unprecedented to say it happened 19 times, as in the Brewer case. And as we point out in our brief, it's just fantastical to claim that it happened 19 times in the Brewer case, and then again in the Brooks case, 20 months apart in the same county. Every expert who's looked at this says there's no scientific basis.
The thing that bothers me about this is, and forensic science as a potential junk science has sort of evolved. This argument that we're using junk science to convict people has evolved a lot since 1992. I suspect were these gentlemen arrested now and tried now, you would haul in the experts that would say this is fantastical and all of this stuff. But 20 years ago, bite mark evidence was considered legitimate to the point that evidently there really wasn't contrary evidence submitted that bite mark evidence is junk science, any sort of Daubert-esque argument. And so we're in a sense judging the conduct of these guys by 2016 standards, by which they clearly fail, instead of 1992 standards, which is what they were dealing with.
Oh, no, these experts, the expert declarations we have look at this as of 1992. I mean, they're saying at the time they had no scientific basis for this. It is unprecedented for it to be able to say 19 times. And you look, we talk in our brief about how Hain and West testified that 100 times in the past 8 years, they had gotten together. Hain had said, oh, this looks like a bite mark. They'd gotten together, they'd looked at the bodies, and in all but a handful of cases, West had agreed they were bite marks. And West had gone on to say that indeed and without a doubt it was inflicted by whoever the suspect was that they decided to accuse.
But I guess the problem that I have is we have a lot of cases, and actually specifically in Dallas County, where they saved DNA for 30 years, there's been a number of exonerations where the evidence at the trial supported the conviction, but then the DNA shows otherwise, and some of that does involve faulty forensics. And as I said, I think it's evolving. I think now there's a greater understanding and realization we have to be more careful with the forensics that are used to convict people. But back then, bite marks were a legitimate science. And so in essence, you're saying these guys are basically incompetent. They have sort of a witch doctor theory, but they're being allowed to present that in court. And it's being viewed as a science then and not now. Now we don't think this is a really very valid approach.
And all they have to do is do what they haven't done thus far, and that is when we have a trial before a jury, as we should based on this record, is bring in an expert to say what you just said and say at the time it was very reasonable for them to believe this.
Yeah, but
I don't know that they can.
It's a qualified immunity analysis. The question is whether any, you know, no reasonable person could have thought what they were doing was right.
If, if, if,
That's an overstatement.
I understand what you're saying. If on this record you say that we cannot go to trial and summary judgment should be granted, I don't think you're going to find a case, or not very many, where someone can sue a phony, fraudulent expert like these guys are, can do it unless they admit that they'd set out to frame these
people. Well, I guess we have Daubert for the reason that the judge is supposed to try to ferret out junk science. So that suggests to me that we have junk science, and not all those guys aren't getting sued for 1983 violations. They're just getting struck from the case or whatever. And so I'm having trouble squaring in my head the notion that every junk scientist is now a 1983 defendant.
We've never said that.
Well, counsel, let me ask you a question, if I might. What do you maintain is your burden of proof with regard to the scienter, the willfulness standard for these defendants?
Well, we have to prove by preponderance of evidence that they intentionally fabricated evidence, or in the alternative, that they did so recklessly. And this court has never announced about the issue of recklessness. We point to the Tenth Circuit's decision.
We have all the time in cases of allegations of medical malpractice in the prisons. And deliberate indifference is the standard, and I'm not quite sure why there shouldn't be a different standard for liability in regard to dead people, you know, evidence, medical evidence from dead people as opposed to treatment of live people.
And in the, you know, the Pierce versus Gilchrist case, which we point to, talks about the recklessness from the Fourth Amendment context from Franks versus Delaware, and says there's no reason it should be any different when you're putting a false statement in a warrant application than when you're making a false statement.
I mean, it just seems to me, if it was so obviously flawed, why did it take 7 years for the exoneration to occur? I mean, as Judge Haynes pointed out, in the Brewer case, there was other circumstantial evidence about this situation, and I don't see a real clear factual picture on the other case. So it's not as if these doctors were looking at, you know, evidence that might not plausibly be connected to a defendant as to whom there was quite serious grounds for suspicion.
I don't quite understand the point, but I mean, Mr. Brewer's been challenging his conviction ever since he's been in prison, and on multiple grounds.
What about the prosecutors in this case?
Well, it's not clear that Brewer was not involved. That's the bottom line.
I understand, and Judge Wingate said the same thing, and he said reasonable minds can differ. And the defendants are entitled to put on that evidence at the trial. But it is a genuine issue of fact as to whether Brewer was involved or not. And that is something that should go before
a
jury.
Yeah, but the point is that on both of these are not guys hauled off the street, accused of attacking a child they have no connection to whatsoever, and the only thing tying them is this bite mark, and that's the thread on which the prosecution is based. Both of these knew the families. And particularly with Brewer, there's a great deal of evidence of involvement. I'm not saying he was involved. I'm saying there's a great deal of evidence to suggest, you know, probable cause. And actually, somewhat with Brooks, who was a former boyfriend and all of that. So again, there's a lot of other evidence involving these guys. And I think that's part of the perspective. You have to look at this on the qualified immunity and on the just substantive merits.
Well, sure, but the accusation here is deliberate misconduct, and you're now talking really about causation. I think we've got a genuine issue of material fact as to deliberate misconduct, and I think there's a genuine issue of material fact as to causation that should be resolved by a jury.
If I could get one question in here,
I apologize, Your
Honor. Assert that there is no form of qualified immunity for a witness testifying in a criminal case?
I think a witness testifying has absolute immunity.
It's what?
Here we are talking, and we have deliberately framed our complaint so that we are not complaining simply about the testimony per se, but about the pretrial communications from these experts to the prosecutors. And there's only qualified immunity.
You're saying that although these witnesses, when they actually offered this testimony at trial, which I assume they did, to be a wrongful conviction, that they were immune, but they didn't have immunity for saying the same thing to the prosecutors.
Precisely. Which we contend caused the prosecutor.
Which means that what you have to argue is that it convinced a trier of the fact that these people fabricated the evidence at the time, which means then that, and the basis for that is you say that at that time there was no, the scientific community was at such a solid mind on this that they can infer from that deliberate indifference. Now, the difficulty with that is that the science at that time, you're going to have to demonstrate, was simply didn't permit this. There was no bite testimony being offered anywhere. It had been completely repudiated, and I don't hear that. I recall in my own mind, perhaps I'm mistaken, about the fallout of the bite evidence, as we have seen the fallout with the reduction in the reliance upon eyewitness testimonies, et cetera. I have trouble finding a fact issue here that's sufficient to allow you to proceed. Now, you say fabrication of the evidence. Of course, if an officer, the prosecutor, fabricates evidence and presents it to the jury, that's something different. That could be a denial of substantive due process.
And we're not saying bite mark evidence was rejected across the board, but this notion of a bite mark that can identify someone from two upper teeth or from just the upper arch is repudiated in this record by every expert who looked at it.
What was the cross-examination at trial here?
I'm sorry?
What was the cross-examination of these witnesses at trial?
They were cross-examined about it, but not very thoroughly. But that doesn't, you know, perhaps if we have a trial in this case, somebody can say, well, it's the fault of the lawyer, not the fault of these experts.
What about the prosecutors here? Are they liable too? They knowingly presented these people.
No, because they have prosecutorial immunity. So they're not liable. We talk about State versus Duncan in our discussion.
I suggest to you that there is an immunity for witnesses.
Well,
it doesn't make sense to
much as we enjoy this, your time is up, and we need to hear from Mr. Shanley.
Thank you.
You have time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I don't know how much time the court would want me to spend on the statute of limitation issue. The lower court analyzed that question, and I can't improve on that argument. In other words, I believe that this case is governed by Wallace. It is governed by Davis versus Zane. It matters not that and state law or the common law of the state of Mississippi and how they identify malicious prosecution or borrow that from the state law informs in any real way the way to characterize what Your Honor has identified as a claim for due process under the 14th Amendment and how the lower court explained it as a substantive due process claim under the 14th Amendment. It is our position that with regard to Brewer, in 2002, there was no extant conviction outstanding. And basically, it was just a question of whether or not it accrued at that time. Counsel opposite speaks in terms of process being issued, distinguishing that case. But basically, the Wallace versus Cato case spoke about that period of time, about lawful process issuing insofar as it differentiated between when the statute of limitation or cause of action would accrue, but a statute of limitation may be delayed under those circumstances, as well as differentiating between when a Fourth Amendment claim is available. Insofar as that goes, we believe the lower court was correct. The cause of action accrued, whether you call it a claim under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution or a malicious prosecution claim under 1983 when the sentence was vacated in 2002. At that time, he had a fully vested right to proceed and should have done so. Having proceeded afterwards in 2008, it was barred by the provisions of 15149, which is the claim provision.
So the other circuits are just wrong. Is that your position?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So you contend that the circuit decisions that post-date Wallace v. Cato are all wrong? Or distinguishable, or what?
I say that this court's decision in DeLorean confirms the holding in Cato, and that is that when there's an ongoing proceeding, basically once the conviction is vacated or reversed, in any event, there is no extant conviction from which heck would impair, under those circumstances, the statute of limitations starts running.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the question of the bite mark evidence, of what was presented actually at trial, we disagree greatly with regard to what counsel opposite has spoken to as to what the state of the record is. Here in the lower court identified two situations whereby both in Brewer and Brooks, Dr. Hain could be considered liable, one having to do with deferral to West, and Your Honor spoke to that question with regard to the state of the science, mentioning in fact that, and as the record does disclose, there was a lot of cross-examination on that point, on that science. Indeed, Levon Brooks had his own expert who confirmed with the state's expert, Dr. West, that indeed they were bite marks, that indeed they were consistent with Levon Brooks, but under those circumstances, he just didn't believe that was a match. Likewise, with the case of Mr. Brewer, it is the case that Dr. Sauvoin, who likewise testified, although he did not believe these were bite marks, he agreed with Dr. West's methodology in all respects, particularly with regard to direct comparison and with regard to his qualifications, experts, and opinions. Actually, Dr. West was voir dired and challenged under Daubert in the Brewer trial. So the state of the science is not as the plaintiff's counsel would indicate. It is rather a situation whereby, and even the authorities that they cite, Pretty and Sweet and several of the other writers and the state of the literature at such a time in 1990 and 1992.
But even if we accept that bite mark, and I think I'm the one who started that line of discussion, but in any event, that even if we accept that in the 90s, bite mark evidence was considered valid science and only now has been somewhat debunked or thoroughly debunked, the experts specifically here were dealing with these front teeth, people who had all their teeth were nonetheless only biting with their front teeth. What about that specific argument that's pretty wacky?
Well, it's kind of wacky insofar as that goes. However, if you would read the testimony of the trial in the Brewer case, you would see that, in fact, although he considers it, that is, Sauvoin considers it ludicrous, under those circumstances, he has seen it before. One is called paradynamic bite marks, which was a full dentation, upper and lower. Oftentimes, however, there's a partial, which involves two teeth, one teeth. It was not unheard of, I submit to the court, in 1990 and 1992.
But it seems kind of weird that a bunch of bites by a person with all their teeth would only be, and wouldn't that sort of put the expert on notice that this is problematic, even in the bite mark world?
Actually, from what I've read of the transcript, Your Honor, and limiting it to the record, I can say that Harry Mincer, who testified for Mr. Brooks, in fact testified that that he had seen such a thing and he was testifying, I think, that same week in a case of a partial dentation. So it has to do with biting through clothes. It has to do with incomplete. I think Dr. West's explanation had to do with he apparently had weaker lower jaw. But anyway, that is West, and we represent Stephen Hain. Stephen Hain has been charged with creating a false autopsy report. And this is what's important in this case. That is a threshold question of the constitutional issue to be decided. That is, this is not like, for instance, excessive force. The right to be free from excessive force is violated by excessive force. This is a causal link that has to connect those two things. It has to be conduct, misconduct, in this instance, the creation of a false or a fabricated autopsy report that in turn creates a deprivation of the right to fair trial protected by the 14th Amendment. We submit that on this record, and as we've argued in our briefs and to the lower court, there's nothing false in fact, nor can science 26 years later create a falsity in fact of the autopsy report. And it comes down to this. Hain's autopsy report basically identifies in the Brooks case bite marks. However, it was an impression of bite marks. It was suggestive of bite marks. And he called in West for the specific purpose of evaluating it. And made no diagnosis. That's what he said. That's all he said. Didn't take a biopsy in the Brooks case. Took biopsies of neck and strap muscles to determine whether or not the cause of death, which was his job, identifying cause and manner of death, was or was not accurate. And they've never challenged that. They've never challenged that the cause of death is freshwater drowning in Brooks, and in Brewer, it's manual strangulation, and that the manner of death in both cases was homicide. Those are not at issue, even with Sperry and Down's affidavit. So what they're looking at is the question of whether or not the autopsy report, the only thing actionable insofar as it predates the right of immunity in this case, the absolute immunity that comes with trial, that act, that creation of that report is false in fact. And we submit that scientific evidence 26 years later can't establish as a matter of law falsity in fact, but assuming that it could, what you would measure it by is what is there. He never identified or dated, he never took biopsies to identify the bite marks. And there's a challenge here that maybe he should have, but the testimony is consistent both in Brooks and in Brewer that he deferred to West to take biopsies.
What are biopsies of bite marks? What do they do?
A biopsy of a bite mark can help to identify it by a different methodology than direct comparison.
Well, it's not DNA, but I mean, I thought a biopsy was when you took a plug out of the body.
As it is used in this case, Your Honor, mm-hmm. A biopsy is excising the tissue and then removing it for further testing. In this instance, it was removed by Dr. West in the Brooks case to determine whatever it is he was
determining. You basically cut out that part that has the bite on it.
You are. That's what you're doing. You're cutting out the bite, and
I haven't seen this on TV. I just went.
Well, and Dr. Hain is a pathologist, and he's responsible for performing biopsies, just as Dr. West is. And Dr. West happens to be a coroner in Forest County during the period of time. He was likewise a medical examiner. He was fully qualified to take bite marks because he was a forensic odontologist of bite marks. And the testimony is unequivocal, and it's in the record. And that is that...
Why was he taking bite marks?
Pardon, Your Honor?
Why was he... You said the coroner took biopsies?
Just the opposite, Your Honor. That is the charge in this case. But the evidence shows that the biopsy in the Brooks case, which happened in 1990, right, was taken by West, our co-appellee, Michael West, who is a forensic odontologist, separately charged from Hain. And he was there and deferred to because he was a forensic odontologist. He had given lectures at Scotland Yard. He had appeared on CNN. He was well qualified. He was considered the only certified odontologist in Mississippi. So when that deferral happened, it happened for that purpose, to take a
specific. I don't think I relied too heavily on appearing on CNN. I've heard some of that testimony on CNN, and some of it's not quite. Doesn't strike me as being persuasive.
Well, this was circa 1990.
Some of it.
In any event, that's what he did. He took the biopsy, and in fact, the testimony elaborates that indeed that West took the biopsy, and later the tissue came back to Hain, and that's where the confusion in the record comes from. That's where the confusion in the lower court as to whether or not Hain did a biopsy. What happened is, and the reason Hain didn't, I submit to you, is also predicated in the testimony, and that is that when you have moderate decomposition of a body, you have slippage, you have tissue slippage. A biopsy is not going to do you any good in terms of timing of the artifact. So what happens is, West takes the biopsy, or rather, West excises the tissue, takes a biopsy. The DA returns the tissue on the eve of trial in Brooks to Hain to evaluate. Hain evaluates, this is in his trial mode, that it is perimortem. And that's an issue that they raise as being a fabrication detrimental to their right or interfering with their right of a fair trial. But submit to your honors that Hain never identified as a matter of pretrial investigative technique, number one, that these were definitive bite marks, and number two, that they were dated to what's known as perimortem, at or around the time of death.
Let me tell you what concerns me with Dr. Hain. I don't know the name of any doctor in Mississippi except Dr. Hain. And the reason I know his name is because we've had so many habeas and successive habeas petitions about this man and his overdoing, the number of autopsies he performed and all of this kind of stuff, lying about his credentials and all of that. I realize some of that's in the record, some of it's not. I would only rely on what's in the record. But how do you address, this isn't just a one-off thing. This guy kind of makes a mistake in one case. It's negligence. So you get qualified immunity. He has a pattern of this. And how do you answer that?
If there's a pattern, it has not been shown, not in any specific sense. It's propensity evidence, Your Honor. Basically, it's evidence to show the character of Hain that would be consistent with what was done in this case. And that's not the standard, not on summary judgment, not in evaluating the merits of the case. His immunity and his right to immunity, whether or not he violated a clearly established constitutional right of Levon Brooks and Brewer, is based upon what he did in these cases, which is what we focus on in the lower court. The lower court ignored that evidence. We submit that under 404, it's just not even probative of anything that's material at summary judgment. It's just not. It's just propensity evidence that he has been sloppy in the past, that he has been criticized in the past.
Is it circumstantial evidence of his intent? That he's just trying to get convictions of everybody under the sun, regardless of the merits?
We would submit that it is not circumstantial evidence of intent insofar as we don't have a question of fact as to what his intent was. We never get there. In the Brewer case, as I was saying, I talked about Brooks. In the Brewer case, which was 1992, again, the testimony is unequivocal. Hain.
You're just saying he relied on West and that saves him.
I'm saying that it was his right to defer to a qualified forensic odontologist in 1990 and 1992, and that, in fact, that odontologist, I don't think I pronounced it, that forensic dentist, in fact, performed biopsies and was the causal connection, if you will, between the violation. Remember, the plaintiffs in these cases are arguing two things. Number one, that he never should have mentioned that these contusions were bite marks. He never should have done that. But, I mean, even Sperry's affidavit and Down's affidavit don't particularly speak to that. That question as to whether or not that was beyond his realm, whether or not that was. And two, was that he communicated this perimortem evidence that led a prosecutor to at least take something that is just a dead child without any indication of where to go for a suspect and move it into the realm of going towards somebody, someone, albeit Hain had no knowledge of who was a suspect or anything like that. And indeed, I would mention, Your Honor, that Brewer was actually in custody when Hain performed his analysis, which I think raises a question under the whether a liberty deprivation was even involved in the autopsy report. Be that as it may, it focuses on those two things, that being the presence of a notation that contusions look like bite marks, and two, that they were perimortem in etiology, that they happened at or around the time of death. The evidence is clear that perimortem testimony was testimony at trial, for which Hain is immunized. And that discussion is not in the autopsy reports whatsoever. So, with regard to the question raised by counsel opposite, having to do with whether or not the court acted precipitously in not granting discovery, rather deciding the question, converting the Rule 12b-6 into a Rule 56 without granting counsel for Mr. Brooks' discovery. It is the case, of course, that even in questions of causation, summary judgment is appropriate. It is the case that the gravamen of the cause of action for denial of a fair trial based upon fabrication of evidence is subsumed within all of the transcripts that we have right now. All of the evidence is before the court right now. There was never going to be anything ever necessary, nor does Mr. McDuff's Rule 56 affidavit indicate otherwise, indicate in any serious way other than that I would like to explore why, you know, a better understanding of what the relationship with Hain and West was circa 1990 and 1992, and perhaps maybe to get them change their testimony. But the evidence for which they rely for their constitutional claim is already before the court. It is full six volumes of transcripts of a trial in Knox County in 1990 and 1992. Thank you,
Your Honor. I think we've heard your argument. Thank you, sir. All right, Mr. McDuff.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Haynes, I think your questions really point out why this case is different. First, you do have these fantastical claims about the marks being made with the upper two teeth or the front arch only. Second, you have it with respect to experts who have a long record of fabrication, and that's pointed out with respect to the State versus Duncan case out of Louisiana, which would be admissible under 404B. That's in section 3D of the Brewer brief. The Brooks brief's numbers are a little different, but it's in the same thing. And in 3H, we talk about the record of the fabrication in other cases by both West and Hain. And then third, you have Hain. Hain didn't just say in an autopsy report that there were marks that were suggestive of bite marks. He went, after he and West examined the body together, and West came up with his opinions that indeed and without a doubt these were inflicted by Brewer and Brooks in their respective cases, and that they were done with only the upper arch, and in the Brooks case with only the two front teeth. Hain went, and with respect to the crucial issue of whether these marks were made when these victims were dead or alive, because if they were dead, they were made in the pond, he went to the district attorney and told them that he believed, in the Brooks case, the Brewer case, he said, he believed these were human bite marks. that were made while they were still alive. And in the Brooks case, he went and told them that even though there was no hemorrhaging, and this is where the biopsies come in, which would suggest the bite marks were made after death and therefore by insects or aquatic activity or whatever in the pond, he told them they could have been made as much as 15 minutes prior to death. So that's a fundamental issue in this case, and those are the reasons, and we set this out in detail in our brief, why there are genuine issues of material fact as to whether they lied.
I don't see why that's material at all. I mean, the one poor little girl drowned and the other was strangled. I mean, I don't see why it makes a difference whether they were involved in necromancy or biting the body, if that's what happened before.
Well, what happened, and we spell this out in our brief in the Brooks case, Dr. Hain testified that the victim in the Brooks case died by drowning. Therefore,
you don't dispute that.
We don't dispute it, and I'm trying to make the point right now. Therefore, if the bites were inflicted after death, they were inflicted, as Hain admitted during his own examination, they were inflicted by, some aquatic activity or insects.
They're already underwater. They were not being bitten by a human. If the girl is already underwater, she's not being bitten by a human.
Exactly.
That's your argument.
Exactly.
Okay.
And therefore, the bite mark does not demonstrate any sort of, is not any evidence against them. And in the Brooks case in particular, I mean, we have talked about, you all.
Of course, you can drown somebody and pull them back up and bite them. I mean, that's, I think, perhaps the,
and perhaps,
the argument being made.
And I assume they can argue that if we get before a jury. There are genuine issues of material fact here on which a jury could find both
are
West
you
and.
Are you going to pull up every case that involved bite mark evidence and go after these doctors?
No. I've spent the first part of my rebuttal explaining why this case is different. And it's set forth in our brief in detail. Of course,
well, you say it's different, but you say it's part of a pattern, so it's not.
It's part of a pattern by these two experts who have.
That's what I mean. This Dr. West was the foremost. I mean, I've saw him in. Wait, just wait. From years, you've been around this bend, and so have I. I mean, he was in a bunch of death penalty cases back around this period of time, and that's why I don't think it's an illegitimate question to ask whether you're going to sue on behalf of all the defendants.
Many of those death sentences have been set aside, including these, well, Brooks wasn't a death sentence of conviction, including Kennedy Brewer's, because West is a phony and a fraud and has a reputation to that effect. And we have set this out in our brief.
But he didn't back then.
I'm sorry?
He does now, but he didn't back then.
A lot of people thought he was.
Well, a lot of people thought so, but they didn't pin it on him until the mid to late 90s.
They didn't use him.
The fact that he got away with it then doesn't mean he should get away with it now. And there's evidence in this record from which a jury should hear this case. And for that reason, we think the summary judgment should be reversed. I wanted to say one more thing, if I can, in response to that, Judge Jones. In the dissent in the Brooks case, Justice McRae in the Mississippi Supreme Court said, we have got to start examining Dr. West more closely, because if we don't, he will become the Ralph Erdman of Mississippi. Erdman was the Texas pathologist. And that's what's happened here. And so West needs to be brought to account in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Court is in recess without further orders.